this week for immediate release. Information on the brand new and upcoming South Pasadena Masonic Con event happening this July. Who will be there? Where can you get the tickets? And what's included? Then, we're going to take a deep dive into a three-part series on ancient Egyptian religion, from creation to administration to the variants that exist from kingdom to kingdom. Through this exploration, we'll understand the ancient Egyptians' fascination and need of the mysteries. And finally, we'll wrap it up with a single card tarot draw. Great news brings security and contentment. All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back. This is episode number 549. We're a little bit late coming out this week because of the travel that I had going to the Esotericon conference, but here we are, we're back, and it's good to be with you. The Whence Came You podcast is brought to you because of our contributors, our fellows, producers, and legacy partners who assist us in supporting this podcast every single month. We've been producing the content since July of 2011, and it's no small lift. So, all the assistance is much appreciated. I want to thank our contributors, fellows, producers, and our legacy partners for all of their help. If you're curious on how you can help the WCY podcast continue to bring Masonic education and its kindred sciences to the masses around the world, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on support the show, and see how you can help, from monthly contributions to even just one-time gifts. Heck, even a dollar helps. We've also got a limited edition shop where we've got some items for sale that you can get, as well as a bookstore that contains all of the books from the people who have been on the program, my own personal reading recommendations, as well as recommendations from our guests. Please check those out. They're from Amazon affiliate links. It doesn't cost you any extra, but it helps those authors out with a sale, as well as a couple pennies come right back to this program to help offset any costs. All right. So, yeah, I just came back from Esotericon, so you might be thinking I'm going to give a huge rundown of the Esotericon. I'm actually not going to do that. All I will say is that it was a great conference. I'm really excited, and if you want to get the rundown, you're going to check out the Masonic Roundtable coming later on this week on Thursday, 8:30 Central, 9:30 Eastern, to hear the rundown. I'll be on the program with three of the hosts. I was really excited. I did get to work on a project that finally was able to be released. I had created a tarot deck with all of the former and current presenters as their own tarot card. We had 21 cards and a white card, which was the explanation of the different cards. And they went over really well, so I'm really happy that everybody out there who got those. They were very limited edition. We had just 120 decks made for the in-person attendees. And yeah, it's pretty rad. So I am hoping in the future to continue to build on that deck as we get more presenters at the Esotericon conference. It's just kind of my little thing that I've been able to put together to give a little bonus to those people who got to show up in person. Do you want to know what those look like? Sure. I think what we'll do is we'll probably put out a sort of print or something that will have all of those in there as a PDF. But I want to thank all of the presenters who did an amazing job and for being cool with being featured on a tarot card that was all put together, right? I do some graphic design, so it was a kind of a mixed media pop art kind of project. Now, before we get into the program, the education this week, I want to announce some really cool stuff. I got an official press release here from South Pasadena Masonic Lodge number 290 FNAM. So let me read that for you now. For immediate release, South Pasadena Masonic Lodge number 290 FNAM Masonic Con weekend arrives in California. Get your rest now. The biggest Masonic conference returns this July, exploring Masonry in the new millennium. May 27th, 2022, South Pasadena, California, the Masons of South Pasadena Masonic Lodge, number 290 FNAM, cordially invite you to the second South Pasadena Masonic Lodge, or SPML, Masonic Con Weekend. Learn more details and purchase your tickets on our website at MasonicCon.com. The weekend-long Masonic Conference with speakers, panels, screenings, vendors, and big pop culture festive board takes place on July 22nd through the 24th, 2022. Be a part of the historic experience. There will be three pre-sale ticket options from now through June 26th, 2022. Then regular price after. Virtual pass, $25. The regular price will be $33. General admission is $99. Regular price, $130. And the executive pass, $130. Regular price, $155. Visit our website at MasonicCon.com for ticket information. The event will have limited capacity. We strongly encourage you to purchase your tickets early. No tickets will be sold at the door. This weekend-long, fully immersive Masonic Conference will bring together over a dozen notable Masonic and non-Masonic scholars from seven jurisdictions that span the entire country, who will be speaking on various topics geared to enlighten the listener on the far-reaching impact Freemasonry has and continues to have in our society, along with discussions on best practices and philosophies the novice or seasoned Mason can apply to enrich and grow the craft in the new millennium. One of our screenings will be the West Coast premiere of the documentary The Masonic Table, The Art of Masonic Dining, with filmmaker Brother Brian Evans, past master, in person to discuss it. If you would like to be a vendor, please contact our secretary for further details. Vendor registration deadline is July 10th, or until limited vendor space fills. Join us this summer, July 22nd through the 24th, as we make history again when MasonicCon arrives in Southern California. A little about South Pasadena Masonic Lodge No. 290. South Pasadena Masonic Lodge was chartered by the Grand Lodge of California in 1888, the same year the city was born. Our lodge has been serving the community and its surrounding cities for the past 134 years. The building we currently occupy, which was built in 1930, is their fourth home. Mayors, doctors, actors, scientists, mechanics, police chiefs, lawyers, school administrators, filmmakers, engineers, and the like have been raised in our lodge, all helping build its eclectic identity that we admire and cherish. Freemasonry, the world's first and largest fraternal organization, is based on the belief that a man who strives to improve himself can thereby improve his community and our society at large. The Masons of California have more than 45,000 members in over 340 lodges located throughout the state. The California Masonic Foundation is committed to making a profound difference for our communities and touches the lives of thousands of Californians each year. If you have further questions, please contact us at the number or email below. Mimo Akari, Past Master, Lodge Secretary. We'll post this in the show notes so you can click it and download it, print it for your individual lodges. I will also put this out in the Lyceum coming out from the Illinois Masonic Education Committee. For anybody interested, you can download that through the Grand Lodge of the Illinois website sometime after the 15th of the month. Who will be at MasonicCon 2022, South Pasadena MasonicCon? Well, I can tell you right now, if you go to the website right now, that $25 virtual pass, the pre-sale price, is going to be, you get access to all the lectures and panels. If you go for the all-access pass, you get everything from the panels and the screenings, access to vendors, you get lunch on Saturday, you get Friday reception, you get the festive board, and a MasonicCon shot glass. So that's pretty rad, right? All of that stuff. But that executive pass, you also get a sticker, a pin, a coin, a hat, a mini poster, and two drink tickets. The speakers this year are phenomenal. They have Jamie Paul Lamb, Brother Bob Davis, Robert G. Davis, right? We've got Brother Chuck Dunning, Brother Chris Hodaff. We've got Brother Chris Murphy, Kirk White, Akram Elias, Mike Jarzabek, Angel Millar, Ron Duncan, Cesar Rubio, Brian T. Evans, and even Mitch Horowitz. There will be several different moderators. We've got Eric Strom and, of course, myself. I'll be helping to moderate some of the panels, and also Brother Ian E. Laurelin, who you may have heard in numerous different things from the Southern California Research Lodge's podcast. They're going to be screening The Masonic Table, The Art of Dining in Freemasonry, which is a documentary, as well as a Q&A session with Mitch Horowitz, the director and producer of The Kybalion. So this is a new film, The Universe is Mental, that says occult scholar Mitch Horowitz delivers a lecture on the history and relevance of hermetic ideas and then presents his award-winning 2022 documentary, The Kybalion, and he'll be doing a Q&A after the special viewing. Now, I'll be moderating that, and I think it will be very awesome. You can check out the trailer for The Kybalion on the website, masonicon.com. And, of course, the festive board, which is going to be really epic. If you got to go to the festive board at the first SPML MasonicCon, it was insanely crazy cool, like a full 7-course meal. But anyway, really great event. Can't stress it enough. You should definitely go. It will be a lot of fun. I hope to see you there. Now, this week, I wanted to read this bit on ancient Egyptian religion, but it's split into three parts. But I think we can just read them all, because they're not super long, and I think it will be really cool. You know, I first got interested in ancient Egyptian religion when I was very young, probably between the ages of 10 and 13, when I picked up a copy of A.E. Wallace Budge's book on Egyptian religions. And I just find it fascinating, especially with some of the connection that we have in terms of the mysteries of initiation and the Egyptian religion, as well as some of the Egyptian connections to the ritual, which have some basis in fact, but also are kind of not really understood in that it's really more about appropriation of ritual through different cultures over time than a direct lineage of initiation passed down from Egypt to Freemasonry. So with all that, I'd love to get into this piece, and we're going to start it right now. It comes from the MasonicPhilosophicalSociety.org, titled Ancient Egyptian Religion, Part 1, published in October of 2018. For the ancient Egyptians, religion wasn't something they did once a week or on designated holidays. They believed that their deities were part of and responsible for all the natural forces around them. Those natural forces included the weather, the elements, animals, plants, and places. The ancient Egyptians worshipped or acknowledged over 1,000 deities. Many of these deities were local to specific regions of the country, but many were universally known. As the Egyptians came in contact with other civilizations, some deities were added to their pantheon. Egyptian pharaohs were also routinely elevated to deity status, and particularly, distinguished individuals were sometimes accorded that honor as well. Most religions have creation myths, and the ancient Egyptians were no exception. They referred to this event as the Zeptepi, which means the first occasion. Ancient Egyptian Zeptepi myths differ depending on the major city of a region, but they all have in common the idea that the world arose out of the primeval waters of chaos, personified by the god Nu. Another common feature is a pyramid-shaped mound called the Benben, which was the first thing to emerge from chaos. The sun was also intimately interwoven with creation, and it was believed to have first risen from the Benben personified by the overall sun god Ra, or as the god Khepri, who represented the newly risen sun. There were many versions of the first appearance of the sun. It either emerged directly from the Benben itself or from a lotus flower that grew there, taking the form of a heron, a falcon, scarab beetle, or a human child. Another common variant of Egyptian cosmogonies, and those of other cultures, is the cosmic egg, which is either a substitute for the waters of chaos or the Benben. One version of the cosmic egg variant has the sun god hatching from the egg, created by the deities of the Ogdoad, or produced by the chaos goose and the chaos gander. The creation myth taught in the city of Hermopolis concentrated on the nature of the universe before the world was created. The substance and qualities of the primeval waters were personified by a set of 8 gods called the Ogdoad. The god Nu and his female counterpart, Nonet, represented the primordial watery abyss itself, Hu, and his counterpart, Huet represented the water's infinite chaos. Kek and Koket personified the primordial darkness within it. And Amun and Amonet represented its hidden and unknowable nature. According to the myth, the eight gods were originally divided into male and female groups. As they dwelled within the primordial waters, they were symbolically depicted as aquatic creatures. The males were represented as frogs, and the females were represented as snakes. These two groups eventually converged, resulting in a great upheaval, which produced the Benben. From the Benben emerged the sun, which rose into the sky to illuminate the world. In Heliopolis, creation of the world is attributed to Atum, a deity closely associated with Ra, who was believed to have existed in the waters of Nu as an inert, potential being. Atum started by creating himself and became the source of all the elements and forces in the world. Atum then formed the air and wind, God Shu and his sister Tefnut, goddess of moisture, moist air, dew, and rain. Next, Shu and Tefnut coupled to produce the earth god Geb and the sky goddess Nut, who defined the limits of the world between them. Geb and Nut in turn gave rise to four children who represented the forces of life: Osiris, god of fertility and regeneration; Isis, god of motherhood; Set, the god of chaos; and Nephthys, the female complement of Set. These nine gods, and sometimes Horus, were grouped together theologically as the Ennead, or Ennead, the version of the creation myth found in Memphis centered on Ptah, who was the patron god of the craftsman. As such, he represented the craftsman's ability to envision a finished product and shape the raw materials to create that product. Memphite theology held that Ptah created the world in a similar manner. Unlike other Egyptian creation myths, this was not a physical but an intellectual creation by the word and the thought of Ptah. The ideas developed within Ptah's heart, regarded by the Egyptians as the seat of the human thought rather than the brain, were given form when he named them with his tongue. By speaking these names, Ptah produced the gods and all other things. This Memphite creation myth managed to coexist with that of Heliopolis, because Ptah's creative thought and speech were believed to have caused the formation of Atum, and thus the Ennead. Theban theology held that Amun was not merely a member of the Ogduad, but the hidden force behind all things. Thebans conflated all aspects of creation into the personality of Amun, believing that he transcends all other deities. One Theban myth equated Amun's act of creation to the call of a goose which broke the stillness of the primordial waters and caused the formation of the Ogduad and the Ennead. Amun was considered separate from the world, his true nature concealed even from the other gods. At the same time, because he was the ultimate source of creation, all the deities, including the other creators, were merely aspects of Amun. Due to this belief, and to the fact that Thebes was the capital of Egypt for such a long time, Amun eventually became the supreme god of the Egyptian pantheon, fusing with Ra to become Amun-Ra. The ancient Egyptian view of the universe centered around Maat, a word that encompasses several concepts in English, among them truth, justice, and order. Ancient Egyptians saw Maat as the fixed eternal order of the universe, both in the cosmos and in human society. They believed that it had existed since the creation of the world, and without Maat, the world would lose coherence. Ancient Egyptians believed that the forces of disorder were constantly threatening Maat, and thus all of society was needed to maintain it. On the human level, this meant that all members of society need to cooperate and coexist. On the cosmic level, it meant that all of the forces of nature, which for the ancient Egyptians meant their deities, should continue to function in balance. This later objective was central to Egyptian religion. The Egyptians sought to preserve Maat in the cosmos by sustaining their deities through their offerings and by performing rituals that forestalled disorder and perpetuated the cycles of nature. The most important aspect of the ancient Egyptian view of the cosmos was the way they conceived time, which was extremely concerned with the maintenance of Maat. Throughout the linear passage of time, a cyclical pattern recurred, in which Maat was renewed by periodic events that echoed the original creation. Among these events were the annual flooding of the Nile and the succession from one king to another. But the most important was the daily journey of the sun god, Ra. When pondering the shape of the cosmos, the ancient Egyptians saw the earth as a flat expanse of land, personified by the god Geb, over which arched the sky goddess Nut. Shu, the god of the air, separated these two deities of land and sky. Beneath the earth was a parallel underworld, and under sky. And beyond the skies was the infinite expanse of Nu, the chaos that had existed before the creation of the world. The ancient Egyptians also believed in a place called the Duat, the land of the dead, which was located either in the underworld or in the sky. Each day, Ra traveled over the earth across the underside of the sky, and at night, he passed through the Duat to be reborn at dawn. In ancient Egyptian belief, the cosmos was inhabited by three kinds of sentient beings. The first were the deities, the second were the spirits of deceased human beings, who existed in the divine realm and possessed many of the deity's abilities. The third were living humans, and the most important among them was the pharaoh, whose role was to bridge the human and divine realms. Part 2. There has been a long debate among Egyptologists regarding the degree to which ancient Egyptians considered the pharaoh a god. The consensus at the moment seems to be that the ancient Egyptians viewed royal authority itself as divine. Thus, while recognizing that the pharaoh was human and subject to human weakness, the ancient Egyptians simultaneously considered him a god because he was the incarnation of the divine power of kingship. In this role, he acted as intermediary between the people of Egypt and the gods. He was essential to upholding Maat both by maintaining justice and harmony in human society, and by sustaining the gods with temples and offerings. For these reasons, one of the pharaoh's jobs was to oversee all state religious activity. The pharaoh was also associated with many specific deities. He was directly identified with Horus, who represented kingship itself, and was seen as the son of Ra, ruler and regulator of nature, as the pharaoh was the ruler and regulator of society. By the New Kingdom, 1550 to 1069 BCE, the pharaoh was also associated with Amun, the supreme force in the cosmos. Upon his death, the pharaoh attained full godhood. In this state, he was directly identified with Ra, and was also associated with Osiris, god of death and rebirth, who was the father of Horus. Many mortuary temples were dedicated to the worship of deceased pharaohs as gods. The Journey of the Soul. The ancient Egyptians had intricate doctrines about death and the afterlife. They believed that humans possessed a ka, or life force, which left the body at the moment of death. In life, the ka received its sustenance from food and drink, so they believed that, to live on after death, the ka must continue to receive offerings of food, whose spiritual essence could still absorb. Each person also had a ba, which consisted of those spiritual and personality characteristics that were unique to each individual. Unlike the ka, the ba stayed attached to the body after death. Egyptian funeral rituals were designed to release the ba from the body so that it could move freely, and to rejoin it with the ka so that together they could become the ak, meaning magically effective one, which they conceived of as mind as a living entity. Nevertheless, it was also important that the body of the deceased be preserved, as the ancient Egyptians believed that the ba returned to its body each night to renew itself before emerging in the morning as part of the Ak. In early times, ancient Egyptians believed the deceased pharaoh ascended to the sky and dwelled among the stars. However, over the course of the Old Kingdom, circa 2686 to 2181 BCE, he came to be more closely linked with the daily rebirth of the sun god Ra, and with the underworld ruler Osiris, as those deities grew more important. By the time the New Kingdom rolled around, ancient Egyptians believed that the Ka and the Ba had to escape an assortment of supernatural perils in the Duat, the realm of the dead, before submitting to a final judgment known as the Weighing of the Heart, carried out by Osiris and the assessors of Maat. This judgment consisted of the gods comparing the action of the deceased while alive, symbolized by the heart, to Maat to determine whether he or she had behaved in accordance with the principles of Maat. If the deceased was judged worthy, his or her Ka and Ba were united into an Ak, There were several coexisting beliefs about the destination of the Ankh. Frequently, the worthy dead were said to dwell in the realm of Osiris, a lush and pleasing land in the underworld. The solar vision of the afterlife, in which the deceased Ankh traveled with Ra on his daily journey, was still associated with royalty, for the most part, but could be extended to others as well. Over the course of the Middle and New Kingdoms, the notion of the Ankh could also visit the world of the living, and magically affect events there to a certain degree, and it became increasingly widespread. The myth of Osiris, Isis, and Horus. The most important of all ancient Egyptian myths was the story of Osiris and Isis. It is the tale of the divine ruler Osiris, who was murdered by his jealous brother Set, a god often identified with the forces of chaos. Osiris's sister and wife, Isis, resurrected him so that they could conceive an heir, Horus. Osiris then entered the underworld and became the ruler of the dead. After he grew up, Horus fought and defeated Set to become king himself. The association of Set with chaos and the identification of Osiris and Horus as the rightful divine rulers provided a rationale for the succession of pharaohs and set up the pharaohs as the upholders of order. At the same time, the death of the subsequent rebirth of Osiris was connected to the Egyptian agricultural cycle, in which crops grew in the wake of the flooding of the Nile, and also provided a template for the resurrection of the human Ka and Ba after death. Another important motif in ancient Egyptian myth was the journey of Ra through the Duat each night. During the course of this journey, Ra would meet with Osiris, who served as an agent of regeneration, so that his life was renewed. Ra would also battle each night with Apep, a serpentine god that represented chaos. The defeat of Apep and the meeting with Osiris would ensure the rising of the sun the next morning, a daily event that symbolized rebirth and the victory of order over chaos. Importance of funerary texts. Among the most notable and thoroughly preserved Egyptian writings are the funerary texts designed to ensure that the deceased made it to a pleasant afterlife. The earliest of these are the pyramid texts. They are a loose collection of hundreds of spells inscribed on the walls of royal pyramids during the Old Kingdom, which were intended to magically provide pharaohs with the methods by which they could take their place in the company of the gods in the afterlife. The spells appear in differing arrangements and combinations, and a handful of them appear in all of the pyramids. At the end of the Old Kingdom, a new group of funerary spells, which included material from the pyramid texts, began to appear in tombs, but these were primarily inscribed on coffins. This collection of writings, known as the coffin texts, was not reserved for royalty, but turned up in the tombs of non-royal officials. In the New Kingdom, various new funerary texts emerged, of which the most well-known is the Book of the Dead. Unlike the earlier text, it frequently features extensive illustrations or little scenes. The Book of the Dead was copied on papyrus and sold to the common people to be placed in their tombs. The coffin texts included sections with detailed descriptions of the underworld, along with instructions on how to overcome its dangers. In the New Kingdom, this material inspired a number of books of the underworld, including the Book of the Gates, the Book of Caverns, and the Amduat. Unlike the previous loose collection of spells, these underworld books are organized portrayals of Ra's passage through the Duat, and through metaphor, the journey of the deceased's Ka and Ba through the realm of the dead. These texts were originally restricted to the tombs of pharaohs, but in the third intermediate period, 1069 to 744 BCE, their use was widespread. Part 3. Temples were a part of Egyptian history from the very beginning, and could be found in most towns at the height of Egyptian civilization. There were both mortuary temples designed to serve the spirits of deceased pharaohs, and temples dedicated to patron deities, although the difference wasn't always clear because of the concepts of divinity and kingship were so intimately intertwined. For the most part, state-run temples were not meant to be places for the general public to worship. Instead, these temples functioned as houses for the deities whose physical images, like statues, acted as their surrogates, and were cared for and given offerings accordingly. These services were considered necessary to sustain the deities so that they, in turn, could maintain the universe itself. Thus, temples were fundamental to Egyptian society, and vast resources were devoted to their upkeep. which included both large estates of their own and donations from the monarchy. Pharaohs often expanded temple estates as part of their obligation to honor the deities, which resulted in many temples growing to enormous size. However, not all deities had temples dedicated to them, and many deities who were considered important in official theology were only minimally worshipped otherwise, and many household deities were the focus of universal reverence rather than temple ritual. The earliest Egyptian temples were small, short-lived structures, but through the Old and Middle Kingdoms they become more elaborate and were increasingly built out of stone. By the New Kingdom, the standard temple was built along a central processional way that led through a series of courts and halls to a sanctuary, which housed a statue of the temple's deity. Admittance to this most sacred part of the temple was restricted to the pharaoh and the highest-ranking priests. In addition to the actual temple itself, temple complexes also included workshops and storage areas and a library where the temple's sacred writings and everyday records were kept, and which also served as a center for learning. In theory, it was the duty of the pharaoh to carry out temple rituals, since he was Egypt's official representative to the deities. In reality, priests almost always carried out these ritual duties. During the Old and Middle Kingdoms, there was no separate class of priests. Instead, many government officials served in this capacity for several months out of the year before returning to their secular duties. It was not until the New Kingdom that professional priesthood became widespread, although most lower-ranking priests remained part-time. Temple staff also included many people other than priests, such as musicians and chanters for temple ceremonies. Outside the temple itself were artisans and other laborers who helped supply the temple's needs, and farmers who worked on temple estates. All were paid with portions of the temple's income. As a result, large temples were very important centers of economic activity, sometimes employing thousands of people. Egyptian temple rituals. State religious practice included both temple rituals involved in the cult of a particular deity and ceremonies related to divine kingship. Among the latter were coronation ceremonies and the Sed festival, a celebration and ritual renewal of the pharaoh's strength that took place after he had held the throne for 30 years. Then, every 3 or 4 years after that, temple rituals included rites that took place all across Egypt, and rites limited to single temples or to the temples of a single deity. Some were performed daily, while others took place annually or occasionally. The most common temple ritual was the morning offering ceremony, performed daily in temples across Egypt. In it, a high-ranking priest, or sometimes the pharaoh, washed, anointed, and elaborately dressed the deity's statue before presenting it with offerings. Once the deity had consumed the spiritual essence of the offerings, the items themselves were distributed among the priests. There were still quite a few less frequent temple rituals or festivals, with dozens occurring every year. These festivals often went beyond simple offerings to the deities and could involve anything from reenactments of particular myths to the symbolic destruction of the forces of chaos. Most of these events were likely celebrated only by the priests and took place only inside the temple. However, the most important temple festivals, like the Opet festival celebrated at Karnak, usually entailed a procession carrying the deity's image out of the sanctuary in a model bark to visit other meaningful sites, such as the temple of a related deity. Commoners would gather to watch these processions and sometimes received portions of the unusually large offerings given to the deities on these occasions. Sacred sites, magic, and oracles. At many sacred sites, the ancient Egyptians worshipped individual animals, which they believed to be manifestations of particular deities. These animals were chosen based on specific sacred markings which were believed to demonstrate their suitability for the role. Some of these cult animals retained their positions for the rest of their lives, as with this Apis bull worshipped in Memphis as a manifestation of Ptah. Other animals were chosen for much shorter periods. These cults grew more popular in later times, and many temples began raising stocks of such animals from which to choose a new divine manifestation. The ancient Egyptians used oracles to ask deities for knowledge or guidance. These oracles are known mainly from the New Kingdom onward, although it's likely they appeared much earlier. People of all classes, including the pharaoh, asked oracles questions, and especially in the New Kingdom, Their answers could be used to settle legal disputes or inform royal decisions. The most common way to consult an oracle was to pose a question to the divine image while it was being carried in a festival procession, and then interpret an answer from the bark's movements. Other methods included interpreting the behavior of a cult animal, drawing straws, or consulting statues through which a priest apparently channeled. The meaning of discerning the deities will confer a great deal of influence onto the priests who channeled and interpreted the deity's message. Popular religious practices included ceremonies, marking important transitions in life, such as birth, because of the danger involved in the process, and naming because the name was believed to be a crucial part of a person's identity. The most important part of these ceremonies were those surrounding death, because they ensured the soul's survival beyond it. Other religious practices sought to discern the deity's will or seek their knowledge. These included the interpreting of dreams, which could be viewed as messages from the divine realm, and the consulting of oracles. People also attempted to affect the behavior of the deities in order to benefit themselves through magic rituals. The word magic is the closest translation of the ancient Egyptian term heka. Heka was considered a natural phenomenon, the force that created the universe in which the deities used to work their will. Ancient Egyptians believed that the humans could also use heka, and magical practices were closely intertwined with religion. In fact, even the regular rituals performed in temples were considered to be magic. Individuals also frequently used magic techniques for personal goals. Although these purposes might harm others, no form of magic was considered harmful in itself. Instead, magic was seen primarily as a way for humans to prevent or overcome negative occurrences. This concludes the three-part series on ancient Egyptian religion, and I think while not necessarily Masonic, coming through this, you know, with Masonic lessons, I think there's plenty to unpack in terms of the ideas of practical magic and what we do in a Masonic lodge room. The fact that we too think about certain attributes that we have and how our use of the working tools and thinking about those changes how we see the world. And when we change how we see the world is actually different. Maybe there is a Masonic heka. My question for the Craftsman Plus is, I'd love to know what ancient culture's religion you're fascinated by. Feel free to leave those in the comments. I know it's been a few weeks since we have had a question in the Craftsman group because of the interviews we had been doing, but I hope that we can spur some conversation and talk a little bit about some of these ancient religions and our fascination with them. Before we wrap up this week, I wanted to go ahead and do a single tarot card draw. For those of you out there who are thinking, what does tarot have to do with Freemasonry? The answer, as I've always said, is nothing. However, what we can do is use the cards to pull one, see what that card represents, and then wonder what we can do with our Masonic tools to assist us in whatever that card is telling us about. So, I'm going to grab a deck right now, and we'll go ahead and shuffle it up and see what we can see. So this week, I'm going to use a deck that I actually unboxed on my TikTok channel, The Wizard of Arge. Feel free to follow over there. And if you're interested in actual tarot readings or anything from me for you, you can find all that information out on our website, wcypodcast.com/tarot. But this week, let's look at this deck called the Vlad Dracula Tarot. Now, the meanings of these cards don't change really based on the deck. So what I'm going to do is I'll pull a random card. We'll see what it means according to this particular deck's writer. And then we're going to use the more practical understanding of that card to see how it applies to us today. And then we'll talk about how Masonry can help us. So let's check it out. I'm just going to open this box. Why do I have a Vlad Dracula tarot deck? While I'm shuffling this, I guess I could talk about that. I collect tarot decks. Various ones. I like the art. I like supporting artists who like to draw out the symbolism that they see in cards and meanings of things and symbology. And so it's one way I can help support the arts, I think, and also talk about some of the unique symbolry that they'll use in order to convey similar things through different archetypes, because that's what this is all about. It's the same stuff, We're just using different archetypes from different symbols or books or whatever the thing is to come together and find something of meaning that'll help us out in life. So I'm just going to randomly draw a card here from the center of the deck. All right, we're only doing one card again, like I said. Ooh, okay, so we got an upright card, which that's nice. It is the Ten of Coins, or in other system, the Ten of Pentacles. And the caption on this card was Vlad's Hidden Treasure. Whether or not that has anything to do with the actual tarot card meaning, probably not, right? It's just a part of the awesome artwork that was put together by Travis McHenry when he put this deck together. So what does the Ten of Coins mean to Travis McHenry? So we're working, of course, this is a minor arcana card, and Travis says that this card means wealth, property, stability, gain, and riches. It's all about wealth, or the creation of opportunities to accumulate wealth or financial success. It also indicates the possession of wealth without drawbacks, without hardships or danger, only financial gain and stability. Man, I don't know of a more awesome card than that, huh? Maybe to help us out. Of course, I'll take a picture of the card, and it will be in the Craftsman Plus group when this comes out. But what does the Ten of Coins tell us in a practical sense? Well, in the practical sense, it means very much the same thing. Wealth, financial security, means your family's doing well. It means you're having long-term success over months and months and months of years. And it means that somebody will help contribute to what you need. So this Ten of Pentacles is really a positive card that we have completed something or we've accomplished something on our way through life. It symbolizes a successful career, that you've made some smart financial decisions. It is very much tied to the idea of abundance, or the law of abundance. And what's very curious about the card, actually, that I think is very awesome, is that this isn't some thing where you get a check and it's gone in a few months. This card tells us that there is permanence in this new foundation that aids us in our future successes. It tells us that our thoughts at being consistent with our movements toward achieving success will have success for the rest of our lives. It also means that maybe we're going to share our success with other people in order to ensure that they are not in want. What I love about this card is that it brings calm to a world that has a lot of chaos, in particular around financial means. It's real easy for super rich people to say, like, oh, live a free and carefree lifestyle. Well, that's so hard for many people who live check to check, or if you were like me a few years ago, check to 2 weeks before the check. This kind of mindset allows us to think about success and being comfortable so that we can worry about the things that truly matter, our families, our friends, and their well-being. Masonically, this could mean that you've reached the pinnacle. You've gone all the way up to the worshipful master seat. Or maybe you got elected to Grand Line, or you've created a successful foundation for your lodge. Maybe you started a new lodge and you have got a great nest egg, or you started a new scholarship fund for your Masonic lodge that is now going to have future success forever. Or maybe your lodge made some great investments and now can live off of the interest. We don't know. It's very subjective, but it's up to us to see the value in these things and say, what does this card mean, which we talked about, and what does that fit with in our lives? Okay, we found out what it could possibly relate to in our own lives. And then we think about what this card supposedly gives us, this calm, this security. And then to bring it full circle, to be gracious and have gratitude for those things. It's about seeing the positive thing, waking up in the morning, saying thanks for that thing that you've got this newfound security in. It's about having that one less thing to worry about. It's about fulfillment on this higher level. So I hope that's helpful. That's it for this week. I want to thank you all for coming with me on this edifying journey of the Whence Came You podcast. I want to thank our producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners for assisting in the production of this program since its inception in July of 2011. Almost 10 full years of this program. I want to thank you all one more time, even if you're just somebody out there who is sharing the program. That's awesome. Thank you so much to all of our listeners, and we'll talk to you all next week. Until then, stay on the level for Whence Came You. I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
CY Media.
My dad said, "Cash girl."